morning to all of you. The podium is sitting further back because I had people sitting behind me who said this morning they could not hear. So I tried to move the podium back to try to make that possible. I do want to tell you that on the drive in this morning, Barbara and I saw something we're still pondering. We think we may have figured it out, but we thought we would let you in on the fun. We came up behind a car on which there was a license plate. Up in the corner was a giant orange T in the back of the mirror, in the back of the back window. The license plate had Tennessee across the top, Volunteers across the bottom, and the license plate was TNACV01. And one pretty much could be an L, so I can see Vol and I can see Tennessee. And we were working on what the AC could stand for. We thought about Ann Curtis. We thought about air conditioning. We thought about a few other things. And not for a while until my son figured it out. I'm pretty sure he's right. You got any idea?
Tennessee Volunteers.
I'm from Tennessee. That's what the reference is. That's got to be somebody who grew up close to where I grew up. he's got the, as we used to say, he's got the pronunciation correct.
They want to have so many letters to work with.
That's right. Yeah. Make do with what you have.
Where'd you grow up?
Just outside of Knoxville. A little place called Jefferson City.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Okay, it is. Yeah, it kind of gets old, doesn't it? So they get rid of the one guy that knew how to win a little bit.
He's been away from Tennessee.
I've been away from Tennessee for years.
Had some of that.
Okay, we've been looking at the book of Psalms, and the original plan was 10 chapters a week, and that would take us 15 weeks. The first week, I think we did 4. Second week we did something like that. So now I had somebody write me an email and say it looks like we're on par for 50 weeks. We'll have to see whether this works or not. But anyway, we're looking at Psalm 10. Okay? Now, what I need you to know, this may not show up in your version of the Bible, but what I need you to know is in my version of the Bible, I did not have Psalm 9 and Psalm 10. What I have is Psalm 9 and 10 combined. And Psalm 9 has an alphabetic letter from the Hebrew alphabet next to verse 1, next to verse 3, next to verse 5. And then when you get to chapter 10, it just keeps going so that 9 and 10 together are an alphabetic psalm. I've told you about the fact that some psalms are constructed that way. That may not survive into English because the first letter of the verse may not be the English letter A when you finish with the translations and stuff like that. But this is a combination of the two. And what I want you to see is if you take a look at Psalm 10, verse 1, we looked at 9 last week, you look at Psalm 10, verse 1, you find a whole lot revealed in the first verse if you can see it. How does that verse read in your translation?
Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble?
I told the first hour that when I read that verse, I was reminded of a joke. The joke is not a particularly good one, but it's a particularly revealing one. And the story is that a farmer and his wife were in the pickup truck on the way to church. And the wife looks up and says, "Why are we sitting so far apart? Why don't we sit close together like we used to?" To which the farmer replied,
I haven't moved.
Take another look at verse 1. If God is in the mind of the psalmist, standing far away, who moved? The psalmist probably did. If the psalmist seems to think that God is hiding when he's in trouble, what's probably going on? There's two things that come to mind there. One I talked about first hour, one I didn't talk about first hour. The first one is, have you ever seen a little baby and played peekaboo? they think if their hands are over their eyes, you can't see them. Right? And the second one is, what happened with Adam after he and Eve ate from the forbidden fruit? God came walking. There's this beautiful phrase in the old, in the King James Version. God came walking in the garden in the cool of the day. There's a song that I sang in a choir years ago that had that worked out in a musical setting. God came walking in the cool of the day, and he says, Adam, where are you? Did God not know where Adam was? Of course he knew where Adam was. What was the issue? Adam didn't know where Adam was. And those things sort of come to mind. When you read verse 1, you begin to realize this whole verse is written out of a perspective with which many of us can identify. Probably all of us can identify based on one point or another in our lives, but many of us can probably identify with it right now. Lord, why do you stand so far away? God hasn't moved, but the distance between us has increased. It seems like you're in hiding when I'm in trouble. It's because I've forgotten which way to look. Okay? Now, starting in verse 2, what is the focus of the psalmist's attention? It is, I believe, in the first two words. The wicked. Does everybody see that? Now, after that first phrase, mostly it's the pronoun they or them or their that captures this. Not every single time, but most of the time. The wicked arrogantly hunt down the poor. Let them be caught in the evil they plan for others. That's an echo of some things we saw in the first few Psalms. They brag about their evil desires. They praise the greedy and curse the Lord. The wicked are too proud to seek God. They seem to think God is dead. That's a very interesting translation. Yours may have something like that. It may not. Verse 4. The wicked are too proud to seek God. They seem to think God is dead. And yet they succeed in everything they do. They don't see your punishment awaiting them. They sneer at all their enemies. They think, verse 6, nothing bad will ever happen to us. We will be free of trouble forever. Their mouths are full of cursing, lies, and threats. Trouble and evil are on the tips of their tongues. They lurk in ambush in the villages, waiting to murder innocent people. They're always searching for helpless victims, like lions hiding, crouched in hiding. They wait to pounce on the helpless. Like hunters, they capture the helpless and drag them away in nets. Oh, may the helpless victims are crushed. They fall beneath the strength of the wicked. And the wicked think, God isn't watching us. He's closed his eyes. He won't even see what we do. Now, that was a real long stretch from verse 2 all the way through verse 11 where the psalmist is complaining about the wicked. Okay? What's his complaint? God, you ought to do something about that. If God did start to do something about it, what would the psalmist do? The psalmist would cheer and probably say something like, well, I'm glad you're finally doing something. I saw a while back that you need to be doing something. Are we okay so far? What does he want God to do? Verse 12. What does it say?
Punish the wicked.
Punish the wicked. Verse 15. What does it say? Break their arms. Go after them until the last one is destroyed. Every one of the wicked destroyed. That's what the psalmist wants. Are we clear? I am so glad we have a couple of perceptive people in here. Rusty says, oh, wait a minute. And Sydney says, or Molly says, I couldn't tell which one.
Careful what you ask for.
God says to his disciples, pray to the Lord of the harvest that he would send workers. If you make that prayer, who are the workers that are likely to be sent? You. The psalmist says, God, break their arms. Destroy every single one of them. Now, I'm letting you get a little ahead of yourselves because you're a little bit more quick than the first hour. The first hour we had to creep up on this a little bit more slowly.
Right. We had more coffee.
We had more coffee.
Yeah. I saw the most beautiful thing this week. Roses are red, violets are blue. I'm not a poet. Coffee. I thought that was...
That's just great. Okay. By the time you get to the end, the psalmist is beginning to think somewhat more widely. Lord, you know the hopes of the helpless. This is verse 17. Surely you will hear their cries and comfort them. Bring justice to the orphans and the oppressed, so mere people can no longer terrify them. The wicked, they. The pointing finger. You've been in here for a while, you realize once that finger starts pointing like that, there's a little bit of a trouble. Now, let's just back up and box this thing in. What is revealed in this? More than the heart of the psalmist, what is revealed is the psalmist's view of the world divided into two groups. And he's in the right group, and lots of people are in the wrong group. We live in a world where it seems to me people are inviting us to think that way. I'm trying not to make overt political statements, but read the newspapers, listen to the language. There's two groups, and if you're not with us, you're in the wrong group. The problem is everybody else. And I don't want to oversimplify it, but I don't want to undersimplify it either. The psalmist has a worldview that says the problem is them. If you just got rid of them, then everything would be right. But verse 1 still stands there and hangs. Lord, why are you so standing so far away? And God would probably say, if invited to, I didn't move. Why do you hide when I'm in trouble? I'm not in hiding, you've forgotten which way to look. That carries us into verse 11. Verse 11 starts in the first verse with one phrase. Psalm 11. Sorry, Psalm 11. We were just in Psalm 10, right? Are we all in agreement on that? So Psalm 11 is next, is that right? Okay, Psalm 11. The first verse, once again, reveals something powerful. How does it start? Mine has a complete sentence, and you're still only about a quarter of the way through the verse. Does yours have that? A clean, clear statement. I trust in the Lord for protection. Period. New sentence. So why do you say to me, comma, quote mark, where does that quote mark end?
End of verse 3.
End of verse 3 is where mine ends. I trust in the Lord for protection, period. So why do you say to me, he hadn't defined who you is, why do you say to me, quote, and then that quotation mark closes at the end of verse 3. Does it? Interesting. And a quote mark there? And a quote mark there? Well, let's try it my way since I'm up here. Shall we?
So this is a dictatorship.
It's a benevolent kind of dictatorship.
I have a cup that I give my wife that says, let's assume I'm right and move on.
I like that.
Has it come back to you yet?
He's by himself today. Come on.
Yeah. I will tell you that I do remember a joke that was running around way back that a husband and wife were asked. The husband was asked what the secret was to their long marriage, and he said, well, we made a decision a very long time ago. I make all the big decisions, she makes all the little decisions. And it dates the joke a little bit to keep going, but I will keep going in the spirit of the joke as it was originally told. So what's a big decision? Whether China gets into the UN. What's a little decision? Whether I take this job, which house we buy, etc. I think you would be well advised to follow that. Okay. I trust to the Lord for protection, period. So why do you say to me, quote mark, and the quote mark, I believe, closes at the end of verse 3. Let's read it that way and see what he says. I trust the Lord for protection. Why are you saying this to me? Here's what he says. Fly like a bird to the mountains for safety. The wicked are stringing their bows and fitting the arrows on their bowstrings. They shoot from the shadows at those whose hearts are right. The foundations of law and order have collapsed. What can the righteous do? Verse 3 sounds like an echo of our day. That's headline stuff for the time we're in right now. Law and order is collapsing. That last question is a question that's being asked in all kinds of directions. What can the righteous do? What is the answer suggested by the psalmist? At least he's saying, it looks like there's nothing I can do. Is that true?
I think he's saying find a defensive position because they're going
to... He's being told. He's being told to find it. Why are you saying to me this stuff? At the end of it, the people who are speaking to him seem to be... If I'm right about where the quote mark goes, and it's not a commentary on the quote mark a little bit early, What can the righteous do? The implication is you gotta just kind of pull yourself out of the situation and go into hiding because there's nothing the righteous can do. Is that true? What can the righteous do? I gave a homework assignment to one person in the first hour. I didn't have the nerve to give it to all. And my assignment was make a list of all the things the righteous can do. We made a short list during the hour. Can we make a short list in here? What can the righteous do?
Pray.
We can pray. Keep going.
Preach.
We can worship. We can get into God's Word a little bit more than we have before. We can begin to listen and notice. And we can begin to act as God prompts us to deal with what we can deal with. And many of the people in this room, first hour and now, you're already there. Because that's where I think God is calling His people to be. So that question hangs out there, and the world's answer is no, nothing you can do. But the truth is, there are things you can do. There are times when the problems are so deep and so monumental, it looks like those things might look small in comparison to what the problem looks like. But that is still what you can do. Look at verse 4. I think the psalmist is replying to those questions from that guidance from his friends. But the Lord is in His holy temple. The Lord still rules from heaven. He watches everyone closely, examining every person on earth. The Lord examines both the righteous and the wicked. He hates those who love violence. He will rain down blazing coals and burning sulfur on the wicked, punishing them with scorching winds. For the righteous Lord loves justice, and the virtuous will see His face. Do you remember what Jesus said about how to heap burning coals on the heads of your enemies? Remember how He said to do that? Pray for them. When they do evil to you, you do good back. And in that way, Jesus said, you're going to heap burning coals on their heads. I don't think it's an accident that those words are in this particular psalm. I suspect Jesus was thinking about this at the moment He said those words. I don't know that, but I think so. Who is God examining? Let me get this one question responded to. Who is God examining? End of verse 4, start of verse 5. Everybody. Every person on earth. Okay, got that locked and loaded, Sydney.
Where Jesus got this phrase, if your fire goes out in the middle of the night, you get up in the morning and you don't have a fire, you take a special bowl thing and put it on your head and you go to your neighbor. My fire has gone out. Can you give me some hot coals to start it again? If they're a good neighbor, they will heap, give half of their hot coals and put a lot in the container. If they're if they're a bad neighbor, they'll give them two, maybe three, and by the time he gets home, they have cooled and are no good. But he takes that that's heaped with hot coals to start his fire again and put it on his head.
That puts a different spin on what's here. And I think what's in verse 6 is pretty clearly not that. So if Jesus' words connect to this, I don't know that they would connect that way, but that's an interesting thing. I'll have to think about that.
But like, the, like you said, you're being good to someone. To an enemy. Yeah. You know.
Well, verse 6 here, that's not what... He's not calling on God to do this. This is different here. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But that's where Jesus got the phrase. What's
your version say? Because I've got the KJV. What would 6 and yours say?
He will rain down blazing coals and burning sulfur on the wicked, punishing them with scorching winds. For the righteous Lord loves justice; the virtuous will see His face.
Mine says fire and brimstone.
Yeah, I think the same thing. Psalm 12. Psalm 12.
Quick, God, I need your helping hand. The last decent person just went down.
I'm the only one left. You remember a Bible character who said that? God, I'm alone. I'm the only one left. Who was that? Elijah. I don't think it was Elisha. I think it was Elijah, but I always get it mixed up. Okay, and what was God's response? He gave a number that could be literal and could be figurative. 7 is a complete number. 1,000 is so many you can hardly count. And he said there's 7,000 left. And that could be literally 7,000, or it could be all I need and lots of them. You're not alone. But it is interesting. That's what the psalmist thinks. And what does he say? Neighbors lie to each other, speaking with flattering lips and deceitful hearts. May the Lord cut off their flattering lips and silence their boastful tongues. Those people, you hear that? Those people say, we will lie to our heart's content. Our lips are our own. Who can stop us? The Lord replies, verse 5, I have seen, I have heard, now I will rise up. Verse 7, Lord, we know you will protect the oppressed, preserving them forever from this lying generation, even though the wicked strut about and evil is praised through the land. Psalm 13, I am going somewhere, and I'm trying to get there slightly earlier than I did in the first hour. Psalm 13, there is a phrase in my translation that is repeated twice in each of the first two verses, a total of 4 times. What's that phrase? How long? How long? We had a woman in the first hour whose daughter-in-law was in a terrible car accident. 14 bones broken in the middle of her body. You think she's not sitting there saying how long? Was it in this hour? No, it was in the other hour. 7-year-old kid. 7-year-old kid with cancer. You think the parents aren't saying how long before we can quit worrying about this? Because we're going to worry about this for the rest of this kid's life. Take a look at the board. Look at the things we talked about. How many of those could you legitimately say, how long, Lord, how long before these things are resolved? That's where it starts. But look again at how the psalmist words it. Oh Lord, how long will you forget me? Will it be forever? Has the Lord forgotten the psalmist? Oh, no, it's not strong enough. What do you have to say? Of course not. Absolutely not. But the psalmist perceives it, right? How long will you look the other way? That's a little bit better question. How long must I struggle with anguish in my soul, with sorrow in my heart every day? How long will my enemy have the upper hand? Turn and answer me, Lord my God. Restore the sparkle to my eye. I love that little line. Restore the sparkle to my eyes, or I will die. Don't let my enemies gloat. Don't let them rejoice at my downfall. But verse 5 and 6 put a different end on that than you might have if it had stopped there. I trust in your unfailing love. I will rejoice because you have rescued me. I will rejoice in the future because you will have rescued me by then. I will sing to the Lord because he is good to me. What does he want the Lord to do? Cut off the wicked, destroy them. Get them out of the way where I don't, not a problem for me. Now we're building all this to try to build a combination between Psalm 14 and Psalm 15. And I want to start with Psalm 14. How does it begin? What's the key word?
Fools.
Only fools say in their heart. Not too many of them would have said it out loud a long time ago. Now they're saying it fine. Only fools say in their heart, there is no God. They are corrupt and their actions are evil. Not one of them looks does good. Verse 2. The Lord looks down from where?
Heaven.
What does he look at? Mine says the entire human race. What's he looking for? Mine says he's looking to see if anyone is truly wise, if anyone seeks God. Verse 3. What's his conclusion? Mine says, no, all have turned away. All have become corrupt. Not one does good. Not a single one. Who did God examine?
Everybody.
Psalm 13 says, everybody. Psalm 14, I think, says everybody. And what's the conclusion? There aren't two groups. There's not a group that God says, these guys are doing great, and a group that God says, these guys are doing terrible. What does God see when he looks? They're all doing terrible. How many of them? All of them. Every single one? Every single one. What does this sound like? It sounds to me like Romans. For all have sinned. All have come short of the glory of God. But Romans also says, I think it's Romans, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. When God looks at people, what does he see? He sees one group, every one of whom needs salvation provided from his son. What does the psalmist see when he looks out? The psalmist sees two groups, us and them. What's in the headlines right now?
Us and them.
Now, it's a different us and a different them, depending on which one you listen to. But nearly every one of them has that voice. Us and them, us and them, us and them. You better get with us. You don't want to be with them. And what I'm saying to you is, I think the psalmist, in 13 and 14, all through here, the psalmist is caught in this. He sees something, but he's not seeing it the way God sees it. And yet, every once in a while, once now in 13, I think it was, once here, God looks down, he sees everybody, and they all look the same. Will those who do evil never learn? Who's speaking now? Is it still the psalmist? Read the rest of the verse. Who's speaking now? I think it's God. Will those who do evil never learn? They eat up my people like bread and wouldn't think of praying to the Lord. This could be the psalmist. If David is writing this, he has people he's worried about, and he could be talking about them this way. Terror will grip them, for God is with those who obey him. The wicked frustrate the plans of the oppressed, but the Lord will protect his people. Who will come from Mount Zion to rescue Israel? What's the answer to that? Who will come from Mount Zion to rescue Israel? Jesus will. And when he does, most of the people of Israel reject him, which is the great irony. When the Lord restores his people, Jacob will shout with joy and Israel will rejoice. Now this begs a question, and that question is asked at the first of Psalm 15. See if you can see it. What's the question?
Lord, who may dwell in your sanctuary? Who may live on your holy hill?
Mine says, who may worship in your sanctuary, which puts an even sharper point on it. Who may abide, yours says. Who may abide. Who may dwell, who may abide. Mine says, who may worship. And I think that's not the word that's there, but I think it's a good word to use for that. Verse 2, verse 3, verse 4, all the rest of the psalm answers that question. Who can enter God's sanctuary and stay there for worship, for living? Here's the answer. If we made a list, I think there might be 10 or 12 points in that list by the time we get there. Here's number one. Those who lead blameless lives. Those who do what is right. Those who speak the truth from sincere hearts. One of the most sad jokes I ever heard was the guy who said, the most important thing is sincerity. Once you learn to fake that, everything else is easy. That's a really bad joke. But it's got a real sharp point to it. We're surrounded, I think, in our world with people who have learned to fake sincerity. And trying to figure out who's faking and who's not is pretty tough. Those who lead blameless lives, those who do what is right, those who speak the truth from sincere hearts, those who refuse to gossip, those who refuse to harm their neighbors, those who refuse to speak evil of their friends, those who despise flagrant sinners. There was a shift at that point. There was a shift at that point. Did you catch it? Those who honor the faithful followers of the Lord, those who keep their promises even when it hurts. I have that one marked in a different way because that's huge. That's big. The ones who keep their promises even when it hurts. Those who lend money without charging interest, those who cannot be bribed to lie about the innocent. Those are the ones who can worship in the sanctuary. How many can get into the sanctuary? Not a one. Not a one. Such people will stand firm forever. Now, you and I live on the other side of the cross. What is the answer to that question? Not a one of us has the right to be there. But we can respond to God's invitation. I don't know that I have a favorite among Jesus' parables, but I do have a few that seem to pop up pretty often. We've talked about it recently, but some of you might not have been here. Do you remember the big wedding feast? The people who were supposed to come started making excuses, so the master said to his servants, just go out to the hedgerows and highways and just anybody you find, compel them to come in. I want my banquet hall full, and they are. And the time comes, the wedding hall is packed with people. The king comes in, looks around, he spies one person, walks up to him and said, friend, how'd you get in here without a wedding garment? And there was no answer, and the poor guy was thrown out. Sounds like that wedding garment was something special. What was that? That was the righteousness of Jesus covering me. The blood of Christ washing me. And it's pictured in that story as a covering, a wedding garment. Friend, how'd you get in here without a wedding garment? Anybody that wants to can get in. Wear the wedding garment. So as I look at this list, I sit there and think, man, not a one of us are going to make that list. And God says, okay, now that you know that, I sent my son. Take a good look at him, because that tells you what's going on. He's dying for you. Accept what he's done for you. Let his blood cover you. Let his righteousness be what I see, because you've put it on. And then the doors are open wide. The indictment of the psalmist is everybody over there is bad. And then all of a sudden the psalmist gets these clues. I think there were three of them across this set of psalms. They got bigger and they got stronger. And when you get to chapter 14, they get huge. God looks down, he sees the human beings, and he does not see the good group and the bad group. What he sees is he sees everybody fall short of where they're supposed to be, without exception. So the psalmist asks, so who can stand? And it's real interesting, because I think the answer he gives is wrong. Because if that's what it takes, it's hopeless. And what's missing here is the ones who said, Lord, I don't measure up on a single piece. Or if I measure up, it's sure not enough. Maybe I measure a little, but it's not enough. But your son died for me. And I've accepted that. And I'm living my life as best I can in light of that. Asking his spirit to guide me. Asking his spirit to protect me. And when I do that, he told me I could be here. And God says, you are right. You've got the wedding garment on. And that's all the time we have for this morning. What's your assignment? Read another 10 or 15 Psalms. Start picking out what you can to see what you can see in there. I have a suggestion. There are some very, very powerful questions in here. Pick one and see what you get for an answer. I think it's a good exercise. Here's one out of Psalm 15. Who can worship in your sanctuary? Who can enter your presence on your holy hill? However that's worded in your translation, that's a great question. See if you can put an answer down for that. I've made some suggestions as how you might do that. You might go to chapter 11. What can the righteous do? In light of all of this, what can the righteous do? I think there's an answer to that. See what your answer is. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for the time you've given us. We thank you for the chance to study your word and to ponder a bit, both what the psalmist saw when he wrote it and something of what you want us to see as we read it. I pray for this church. I pray for all of us who are serving within and through this church. And I pray for the effect that we can have to help a lost world come to know you better. That can only happen if we begin to speak about all you've done for us and speak not out of arrogance and pride, but out of humility and gratitude. All this we pray in your Son's precious name. Amen.